welcome to Idle Red Hands Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
And what is Idle Red Hands Weekly? It is when someone takes it upon themselves to decide who does or does not have access or rights to a community or identity.
Isn't that gatekeeping?
Yes, it is. Okay, well, I guess that's not us. Okay. I was thinking about that because of Gen Con just happened. And it's very funny. There is no point in gatekeeping, especially something owned by Hasbro or any of these types of hobbies anymore, because the corporations that own these are very interested in broadening their customer base as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So they are actually not interested in you doing that. And in fact, inclusion and diversity in that hobby is what they want. That's good for their bottom line. So they're going to push that as hard as possible. So I think that is where we're kind of getting this friction between OSR kind of old school people that do, that did protect this hobby as this is a geek pastime, and the newer generation of people that are being welcomed by the broader kind of corporate face.
Overlords?
The corporate overlords of Hasbro are more interested than anything to get new audiences and a new generation involved. So it's funny, though, that as much as the maybe new generation of people feel, yeah, now this is finally for us, it's for you because, you know, you're adding to the bottom line. It's not actually, they don't want to lose the old audience. Right. They're not changing audiences. They're just opening the door a little wider because they want more people to come through. And so I think there's with a lot of hobbies and, you know, kind of fandoms and things, I think there is a weird mentality that I think eventually it's affecting people subconsciously, because eventually they are just realizing they're being used. You're just paying. Give us your money and go the heck away. No. But I want to write fan fiction. No. You know, cease and desist. You know, I want to do this. You know, you want to be involved. So it's almost this abusive relationship that some people have lived their whole life from very young childhood in, where they like these characters. They're like, okay, just buy the goods and go the heck away. You're not participating in this. You're a customer.
Do you think that's the case, though? What with like the DM's Guild? I mean, using the D&D analogy, the DM's Guild is essentially a marketplace that D&D and Hasbro have set up through DriveThruRPG, where people can essentially sell their fan fiction.
Oh, yeah.
They get, I mean, the corporate overlords get a decent, huge cut. And I mean, I think there's better places to sell your stuff. Maybe not for D&D. But in terms of like gatekeeping, I agree. For games like D&D, didn't want to say that one. Yes. Okay. They're owned by a corporation, and so it behooves the corporation to get as many people as customers as possible.
Right.
For other types of games that sort of don't have that corporate overlord thing, I guess, you know, kind of indie games. Sure. I guess it's the same thing. You know, designers, if they want to be paid for their stuff, the more audience or the larger audience they have, the more revenue they're going to get. But in terms of like the gatekeeping thing, I think, sure, there's the kind of herd mentality of, we all like this thing and that's all great and let's all stick together. And yeah, I don't understand the, and you can't join. I mean, unless that person's a bad actor, in which case we don't want your bad vibes in this community.
Right.
I guess I do kind of understand people who've invested a lot, and this kind of gets into like system mastering stuff to bring it back to role-playing games. I've devoted so much time to studying and mastering this thing, and you just joined. I don't think, but people think there's got to be some kind of distinction between me and you. Otherwise, it's the same with comic books or any kind of fandom, as you said, Marvel, whatever. I've been a fan of this for however long, and you just joined, and we cannot be equal, because then the amount of time and effort and energy I've put into studying and learning this thing is meaningless.
That's true.
I get why that's upsetting. At the end of the day, it doesn't fucking matter. It's made it, right? Just like, I agree. It's hard to let go of. And I guess if you're talking role-playing games, especially, what, Satanic Panic and getting tossed into lockers and stuff, there's the, understandably, but not correct, the resentment of it becoming mainstream and not getting that kind of abuse and going through. And I understand some people would take that badly and kind of turn it around, being like, no, you can't join because you didn't go through this whatever hazing period.
Right. So. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good point, too, is, when you join, and it's kind of like, you know, how sports fans don't like the bandwagon jumpers
when
team is, you know, going to the Super Bowl or the World Series. Yeah, that kind of stuff is so frustrating because we were there when they were losing.
Or if you're in from Philadelphia, it's like, not when the Eagles are going to get bad. It's not if, it's when. It's just right. Like, okay, how long in the season before they crap? Oh, yeah, okay. So I'm a sports fan, but.
Yeah, so it's almost like people need some kind of designation, some kind of letters to put after their name to show how authentically, you know, how long they've been involved in their hobby and how, I mean, you can't get a PhD in it, but I'm sure if people could, they would, PhD in Dungeons and Dragons.
Don't people kind of do? I mean, how many Reddit posts or whatever posts start with, I've been DMing for 10, 20, 30, 40 mm-hmm. years, and the realization, like, dude, that doesn't mean you're good at it, necessarily. I mean, it doesn't mm-hmm. mean you're bad at it, but...
Yeah, it's funny, and it is just a hobby, but yeah, people feel very territorial.
It's not just a hobby. Oh, that's it's D&D. Yes. Come on, get it right.
Yeah, so I guess bringing up Gen Con, I'll bring this up. So there was something that I was amused by that I think a lot of people weren't. And it has a lot to do with just like where we had the controversy at the UK Games Expo. And we're talking about mainstream and kind of corporately owned, corporately run things. They want to broaden this as much as possible. They want to make it family friendly because they don't want people to not be able to come just because they need to push a stroller. Right. So, you know.
Well, based on the number of people attending, I would not want to push a stroller through that morass of unwashed gamer flesh.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that would be pretty traumatic. I think that is child abuse. Oh, jeez. So the creator, and I don't have his name down.
Oh, here. James Raggy?
Yes. The creator of Lamentations of the Flame Princess printed a catalog, and the cover featured some art with the title Kids on Pikes. So instead of Kids on Bikes, the, you know, kind of Stranger Things.
Right. There's a role-playing game called Kids on Bikes as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's that created by the 80s nostalgia mm-hmm. filtered through people that were born in the 90s.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
It's that softer, gentler kind of role play. So it's when somebody tried to make it dark and ugly using Things from the Flood at the UK Games Expo, we ran into this. And then this creator does darker, edgier settings.
Did you hear the air quotes on that one for me? Yeah.
Settings for fantasy. And so using this provocative image, I mean, it was very amusing to me because... So
you didn't say what it was. It's the...
Oh, sorry.
It's the four kids from Stranger Things with... As literally heads on pikes.
Bodies, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, they're impaled like Vlad the Impaler style.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah, so you can't see their faces, but you obviously see it's Dustin with his hat
right,
and curly
okay,
hair.
Okay.
Yeah, so, it's the kids from Stranger Things impaled on pikes with a character like drinking wine or something below them.
Okay.
So very much saying, you know, this is not our version. You know, this is our nostalgia. And so... You know, the title and the content, I liked it. It was a little punk rock. It was a little edgy. It was just like, you know, we're not into this. If you want that kind of, if you want that warm and fuzzy thing, that's not what we do. Mm. But the fact that it was put on the cover of a catalog that's a free giveaway, that's a little bit difficult because they're going to be handing it straight to people that might have a pretty, you know, serious reaction. Might be with their kids at the time and say, oh, right. you got murdered kids on the front of your, is this what you're all about? But
I would say the answer is yes.
But it tickled me because that's my reaction. I mean, I am kind of disgusted by that's, you know, become kind of a face of role-playing and things.
Oh, Stranger Things.
Yeah, it's kind of retro. Yeah, that the kids on bikes, it's safe, it's gentle. And, you know, Tales from the Loop is a good system that doesn't have any death. It is probably a good kind of gateway for people that want to try RPGs that don't want to stick swords in goblins' faces. But at the same time, that can't be it. That can't be all there is, you know. So I just liked it as a statement of we're still here. We're still messed up. You know, we've still got some problems. We still like weird stuff. And I like that image exists.
That's fair. As you said, though, with Gen Con trying to be more family friendly.
Yes.
It's not censorship because Gen Con is not the government.
Mm-hmm.
So Gen Con would be, I think, well within its rights to be like, yeah, no, you're not giving that out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And that's come up many times in comic cons is, you know, mostly my experience. And that comes up a lot because as things get bigger and more friendly, like they're putting post-it notes over nipples on fantasy art, you know, so art dealers and things have to deal with this sort of thing. And I think what then needs to happen is you break off an indie show. You break off a separate show that people know this is, and so then you don't have all the bullshit. You don't have any kids on bikes, you know, at your indie dark RPG con or whatever you're going to call it. So that you still have access to that, and it's not going to be in contrast, you know, to a family-friendly thing. It's because you don't want it to be in opposition, and you don't want to have to be behind a curtain, you know, at a show. I mean, that is an option, but that does kind of end up kind of segregating you and kind of marginalizing the people that want to make those kind of games. And I think it's valid. They're valid to play. They're valid to create, but they're not valid to try to, you know, put in kids' faces.
No, I agree. I mean, you can make whatever you want, but you kind of then have to face the consequences. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, this show isn't geared towards the stuff I make, and it stinks that it's the largest one that I want to participate in, and my sales or whatever are going to go down and having to go to this other smaller or start my own kind of thing. But it's like, you made that choice.
Yeah.
You decided to do that, so that's kind of what you got to deal with, unfortunately. I have feelings since Lamentations of the Flame Princess is one of the few RPGs that I actually kind of wanted my money back after getting.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. I was very impressed by your description of the free PDF versus the paid version.
That's what got it. It was like, after buying it for about like $20 or something like that, found out there's a free artless PDF version that is exactly the same product just with white spaces over the art. So, and as I was not that impressed with the system or the artwork, really, to be all that honest, I felt I paid $20 for artwork that I did not like.
Right. So,
that and Numenera are among the RPG PDFs I wish I had my money back on.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm sure the list will continue to grow.
Hopefully not. Hopefully I've going to make good decisions from now on.
So how about you this week? Anything?
Apart from getting some blank dice to run Alien RPG at the end of this month, not a whole lot, because my kid is being a real pain in the butt. So there's not a lot of time for me to do stuff. I ordered, 40 blank dice from the Dice Shop online. It's a UK retailer, and they arrived pretty quickly, and it was less than $20 for 40 blank dice, including international shipping to Japan, which normally is ridiculous. I got 20 black, 10 yellow, and 10 red, because I couldn't decide what color I wanted the stress dice for Alien to be. The black and the yellow contrast really well, but the black and the red also, I mean, red stress. So what I got to do now is paint the symbols on them. Haven't decided what those are going to be yet, but should be fairly easy.
Cool. Yeah, I was curious. I was wondering if you knew something I didn't know about the system, because they haven't released the full rules yet. And when I saw you had two different colors that weren't black, I was like, oh, are they going to do gear dice? Because the Forbidden Land system, you have to separate skills, gear, and your kind of core dice are separate colors. So I was like, oh, is the system going to be that different between cinematic and campaign play?
Interesting. I didn't know that. I just couldn't decide whether I wanted the red or the yellow for stress dice. And it was only like $3. I just said, why not? Okay. How do the gear dice work in Forbidden Lands?
When you fail, you have to pay attention to what die failed.
Okay.
So when you're rolling the attributes, so if you're rolling strength for a physical attack or agility for a ranged attack, you actually take damage to that stat.
Right.
So you gain a condition that is, you know, you're weakened, or you're, if it's a mental, if you've done something with empathy, or wisdom, you have a mental effect, or you have a movement effect if it's agility. But if your gear rolls, if your gear fails, then you take damage to that gear. Okay. And so gear only has a certain amount of durability.
Right. Okay.
And so you can break things using them. And then with skills, failure doesn't matter.
Right.
With specific
you can't lose dice. Your skill ability.
Right.
Right. Okay.
But that's how they kind of track your damage and then wear on your gear. And I think it also is true with armor. If you fail on an armor roll, that means your armor is getting damaged. So you can basically have it stripped away.
Well, that kind of makes sense for that setting. I mean, because gear is, you have to replace swords and shields and stuff like that. I didn't see that in the Alien cinematic RPG, but I mean, probably do it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I would, though, because I think, as we were discussing before, the roles for consumables, like power, oxygen, ammo, I think that already kind of fills that area of your gear is not, might not last that long, or you're going to have to go get that reload for the incinerator, or, oh, you're out of O2 kind of stuff. So I would be surprised if they also toss in those gear dice. Maybe they will. Who knows?
Yeah, I hope not. I don't think so, because I think the way that it's working right now is nice. I'm curious to see how character creation is going to work. Hopefully the system will stay mostly the same, because I think it works. And I think relying really heavily on that stress mechanic, you know, to kind of bring tension up. But when you're playing a campaign, I'm curious how much that actually kicks in. And like, you know, if you're going to, we've been here for a week and I've been freaking out for a week. that's a little odd. So we'll see like how that changes in.
I'm really curious to see the campaign play. I'm almost kind of, after seeing cinematic, I'm kind of skeptical of what it's going to be like. I might try and reverse engineer some of the characters in that cinematic thing as well. Because I think I'm going to strip out first names, and like the original Alien script, just have family name. Be like,
I like that.
Not make any kind of association about like gender or pronoun. Just like, here's the name, whatever you kind of want to be. Maybe even take out the picture, as you did for the black and white character sheets you made.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I think that works well. That was the problem, because I was using the genders that they kind of pre-assigned, and we didn't switch anybody over. But I think that works well. And I think that's much easier to remember when you're...
We kind of used family name when we were in character.
Yeah, yeah. I think that worked. And yeah, I think that's very appropriate to the setting too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's how most of the movies run. Even Newt was yelling, Ripley.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are going to be no kids.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they actually put a kid in the cinematic start. I was like, wow, okay, if that happened, no, not getting used because...
Yeah, that was very... Yeah, so I ended up using that for the picture of your younger brother
cancer. Yeah, that's why. Yeah.
Because, I didn't think that was going to come up. He was basically going to stay on the ship and not come
over. Yeah. Not putting a 12-year-old on this horrible science vessel.
With an incinerator, I think he's...
Oh, yeah, it's exactly incinerator. Yeah. Spoilers for Chariot of the Gods cinematic starter.
For me this week, speaking of foolish decisions,
uh-oh, okay.
I've invested in some contrast paints, some of the new Citadel contrast paints.
Which is what exactly?
So that's the new style of thick as you want, throw it on one coat, and it's going to give you a highlight. It's going to give you the effect of a wash, and it'll give you like a transition. And so that's basically they're kind of coming up with a combined version of a glaze. It's kind of a glaze and a wash together. And so for the details on the Citadel miniatures, which are really nice, you know, nice and fine, you can basically just base them in a primer made specifically for this paint. So I think it's got some tooth or texture on it. And then you just hit it with that color and the pigment pulls away. So at the highest surface, it pulls away, giving you a highlight. It sits in the recesses like a wash does, but it gives you a transition. And I've seen kind of various results, and the whole range doesn't seem to be working very well because, of course, the pigment is different material. You know, the pigment for each color is different material, so it all operates a little bit differently.
You mean among the contrast paints themselves?
Within the contrast paints, it does seem that, you know, whatever the chemical or compound is that is the pigment, it reacts a little bit differently between colors. For some of the browns and earth tones and even the skin tones, they're getting really nice results. Wow. Yeah. So this is how I've decided to try to approach the orc army that I invested in last Orktober.
Orktober. Oh my God. Okay.
And because I really like the more organic, not such bright green orc color. And they've got some really nice greens in there. And then, of course, all the leather and the, you know, black and everything.
Don't forget all the dirty metal, like tin bits and stuff.
Right. So I think it'll work well in a combination of those things. I was really curious to try it. And the one worry that I had is, so orcs have a lot of vehicles and with big, broad
that
surfaces.
That should be red.
Yeah, right. And that these paints do not work well. They're made for very small, very detailed, because it needs some place to grab onto.
Yeah.
Right. So a big, broad surface, it looks terrible. Like people have had.
Does it look modeled and kind of like spotty?
It looks like, like watercolory. It pools in weird, unpredictable ways. It doesn't add anything that looks like a natural light or anything.
Right,
it just
okay.
And it dries, you know, because the pigment is just pulling away. So it does that in weird places. Mm. So it doesn't look nice. So when you have big flat surfaces, you don't want to use that.
Would it work for chaos? Because that sounds pretty decent for Nurgle.
Oh yeah, no, I think so. And that's kind of what I was really interested in trying it for. But yeah, because they specifically have like Nurgle flesh and things, and for for most of the Nurgle, especially the demons, I think it'll work really well. Because that's basically how I was painting anyhow. I was just white basing them and then just using washes.
Oh, right,
and then for like horns and spikes and things, I would do a more opaque color. But you can just let those washes run into each other. And just like watercolor painting, that weird, interesting stuff happens when purple and green meet.
Right.
Yeah, so that kind of stuff was really fun. So you get like weird bruising and it's great. So I'm curious to see how these work. So I invested in a few and I'm going to try to do kind of orc flesh and leather and stuff, but I still want to do a lot of metallics and stuff. So I don't want to do 100% contrast, but I want to see if this helps speed things up.
Right.
If you can hit it with one coat and it looks okay, or if you still need to do a lot of highlighting and things, I'm not sure how much it's going to save.
I would think it kind of, I had heard about contrast paints before, but didn't know what they were. And I guess it kind of, again, behooves Games Workshop to come up with these, I guess, faster methods of painting, because back when I was in the hobby before getting sucked in shortly and disastrously by that kill team, damn you Games Workshop, I remember there being a broad spectrum of people in the hobby, from people who just kind of wanted to play to people like myself who are more focused on the modeling and only had about like 5 models done at a time.
Right.
I think most people kind of want to show up with at least a painted army. So Games Workshop coming up with methods of allowing people who aren't really or skew more towards gamer than hobbyist can paint their models fairly quickly and easily and just kind of be done. I remember staying up all night with painting with my brother before a quasi tournament uh-huh. because we were trying to follow that three color rule uh-huh. on his massive Cadian, yeah. you know, army back when they were all metal.
Right.
And we're just sitting there like hours and hours and hours until like who knows how late at night and showing up the next day mm-hmm. for this tournament. And we're like, your Chaos army is bare plastic and half of the guys don't even have arms on them. Why do we stay up until God knows how late
yeah.
with all these stupid metal infantry? I don't know. That was kind of the end of my Games Workshop. And I'm like, I think I'm kind of done with this.
Yeah. I think, and this probably has a lot to do with now they have access to, you know, everyone's Instagram and, mm. and to see when people say, here's the first model I painted and they're just getting into the hobby,
right.
what they do. And they basically just, you know, all the leather is brown, mm-hmm. all the flesh is. And so they're using one color and say, look, I'm done. And yep. it's like, well, yeah, but then there's so much more you can do. Mm. You know, you can wash it and highlight it and dry brush it. But this gives you a decent effect painting that style, right. just saying, right. this is brown, this is red, this is green. I'm done. Mm. And it really does seem like they're thinking that way because you can't overlap the contrast paints.
Oh, they don't work.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't cover up. Like if you go over. So when people very carefully are painting their models in very flat colors and right. say, look, I'm finished. That's exactly what they want you to do
okay.
because you have to use other paints if you need to cover up contrast mistakes. It's not, you know, because they have some transparency mm. because they kind of move, they don't mingle, I think, as well as washes and things do. And the overlapping isn't interesting. You just see brown under your yellow.
Oh, wow.
Whatever. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think it's really meant for that kind of first step before you even think about any of the, you know, edge highlighting and all right. the stuff that they have tutorials for.
All the stuff I used to be able to do.
Right. Yeah. So I'm curious to try these, and I don't know if it's going to be an interesting or useful tool for how I want to paint,
right.
but I think it'll be, if I just kind of like, I'll do this army in this way. Mm. And I was like, ugh, this doesn't look great. It's not the end of the world. Yeah. It would just kind of an attempt to utilize these new tools and see if they are just for, they're strictly a beginner paint and they're strictly, yeah. you know, only going to work with one.
Possibly strictly a beginner paint. Are they beginner prices for GW?
No. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So in Japan, they're 1,000 yen a pot. Yeah,
and
but they're pretty big pots, though.
Okay, pretty big pots.
Yeah, they're kind of. I don't think they're quite as big as the double size that they're right. making now, but they're larger than the like 1.5.
Right, right.
Whatever.
Other question.
Yes.
Do the caps snap on properly? Because I remember so many times opening my pot of paint and going, "Oh, it dried out," because you didn't yeah. engineer caps that snap properly.
Right. They look pretty similar. I mean, they're doing okay because the caps are kind of flexible.
Right.
So even okay. if you get some dried paint around the edge, you can still
paint's existence.
Right. It seems like you can still kind of squeeze it on. But yeah, it looks pretty much the same. And I have no idea like what the bad version is. It does look, though, like they don't mix particularly mm. well. Because looking at the bottom of some of the colors, there's just white. There's just
oh,
like,
right.
yeah, yeah.
Okay. So you got to like drop yeah. a BB in there or something to shake it up.
Maybe, yeah. yeah. There might be something that you need to get it to really be well mixed because they've got a couple of different.
I'm sure Games Workshop will come up with a miniature paint shaker.
Right. And it'll be very reasonably priced.
I'm sure. Oh, yeah. Reasonably priced. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be the adventure of, I guess, probably over this holiday. We've got the Ooh. Obon holiday coming. So I'll have some time at home and do a little bit of that.
Yeah, I'll be at work. Yeah. But I'll have the apartment to myself for a couple of days. So I got a bit of holiday, too.
Nice. Oh, and also I was taking a look at The Witcher. I was playing a little bit of The Witcher 3 that was super cheap on PlayStation. So I was playing a little bit of that and really liked that setting. And they just, they're working on an RPG.
I thought it was out.
Or
I saw something on DriveThruRPG.
For free RPG day, they released a what they called easy mode. So okay. kind of their starting adventure. And it may be out already because I've been kind of holding onto this for a while. Things kept getting in the way. But it may be out already because I know it's coming out like summer or fall. Maybe, yeah, it probably was August, so it could be out already.
Oh, maybe.
So the full version of it. But the setting is very interesting because it's not the Tolkien,
right.
Scandinavia, Celtic lore. It's more Eastern European.
Okay.
So there's a lot more, you know, curses and witchcraft and dark magic. But it's not grimdark. I wouldn't call the setting necessarily, you know, grimdark, but it has a very different flavor. Because it's a Polish developer, so a much more different flavor. A Polish writer, I'm sorry. It's based on the novels of a Polish writer who actually hates the video game.
Oh, really?
Passionately. The setting's very a nice, kind of interesting flavor, and it shows you like how broad the actual experience of kind of, you know, Middle Ages or medieval kind of European is. And so that was one thing that made me think about a topic is, do you think that RPG settings and things like this are actually a good way to share kind of unfamiliar or not well-known cultures so that people can actually participate in something, or do they necessarily have to be too idealized or kind of too altered to make them playable?
I mean, interesting. That would be an interesting topic. And unfortunately, I think my answer would be it depends. Mm-hmm. Because I can see, I mean, there's any number of tabletop RPGs that are based on kind of the mythology or kind of folk tales and legends of different cultures, more or less successful and kind of better or worse than other ones. And I can't think of any specifics. For some of them, it might be hard to come up with what the characters do. Mm-hmm. And rather than setting, I've seen people try and pitch games more as, okay, great, that's great, setting. What do you do in this game as characters? What do you do? And any number of times I've watched a media or consuming and be like, oh, that setting's awesome. And then, and what do the characters do? I have no idea, which means the game won't work.
Right.
So might as well just throw it out. So I think as long as the characters could have something to do in that mythology, or you can kind of find some ways for them to interact, which is maybe why things like a Greek and Norse mythology are some of the, not better ones, but the easier ones, because the gods are always kind of poking around mortals, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's things you can have characters do.
Right.
I mean, it'd be really hard to do one in, I was going to say kind of like a modern religion, like Christianity, where there's not a lot of interaction.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Oh, then I suppose, actually, I take that back, because I thought it would be interesting to play in a game where it's not D&D-ish in terms of, or in meaning that you don't actually know gods exist, and it's a bit just more kind of faith, actually faith-based.
Mm. I think that might be an interesting thing to explore, and whether or not that's helpful, because you want to, I think it is a vehicle for giving people the opportunity to say, yeah, but no, in this culture, they don't do that. And you'd have to get your head around that. Like, how would I play a character that, you know, all marriage is, pre-assigned from birth, or, you know, you have like this weird kind of gender roles that are very opposite of your culture that you have to kind of.
Oh, you mean the one that were originally there before everything got colonized?
Right. Yeah. So those sorts of things that make it more thoughtful, because role playing does have that built in where you're trying to figure your way out around in a world. And if it's if it's based on real cultures or real experiences, I think that would be fun to bring into.
It would be. I mean, there's a whole bunch of pitfalls in that, I guess, in doing it. And the big one is, well, if you're going to write about a culture, then make sure you actually have writers from that culture.
Yes.
Rather than trying to be...
Right. I think that's a good point, because that's the danger. If you're making it as entertainment, then you're not going to be very true to it, and you're kind of going to be almost parody. So that's a line that you have to be careful of. But I think that there is something good there. And just like you have, you know, historians, people that study the history of China that are not Chinese, I think there is, if you approach it academically and thoughtfully, I think you can avoid some of the other, looking at it as wrong, you know, the Occidental versus Oriental.
in that example, you kind of run into the problem of, why are the, quote, experts on this culture not actually from the culture? I mean, you do kind of academically, okay, whoever studies this culture, sure, they would be a better voice on it than I am, because I don't know anything about it.
Right.
But then you're still kind of like, okay, well, and I'm explaining this very poorly, why is this person, despite having studied it, why is their voice more important than someone who might have actually lived or be a part of that culture?
Yeah. Well, I don't think they...
And that's not what you were saying, but I'm saying kind of that is another potential danger. Right. Even if you have an academic writer, having them write it kind of elevates their voice more than someone who's actually lived it.
That's true. And they are coming from their own experiences, their own lens, so that it's going to be a translation. You know,
That's a good way to put it, it's translation. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that is the danger and the difficulty. And I think at least being humble or aware of that, and knowing that we will make these mistakes, and if this is actually offensive, or if this is actually ugly, you know, what we've done, then to be able to step back from that. Yeah.
That's why you hire sensitivity readers.
You know, that's a good point. So for Kickstarters this week, I wanted to mention the Hope RPG by Corey Beatty. The thing that really appealed to me, it has a really modest campaign goal. So it was only a $500 goal, which they've already reached. And it's a post-apocalyptic setting that's based on an engine he's been working on. And it's a D10 roll under mechanic. And the setting basically said either kind of a frozen wasteland or a desert wasteland. So maybe similar to Canada or Mexico. Flat, uninhabited areas. And so your job is to rebuild the settlement of Hope. So the name from the RPG is the name of your settlement. It's got really nice art, and they're going to print it as a small format at cost book. So I think like a A5 or B, six, whatever the kind of booklet size is on DriveThruRPG, the minimum pledge for just the PDF is $5. And they already said in the campaign itself is that this is basically the first setting for that they've play tested very well with this engine. And they already have the art. They already have everything ready to go with this game. So the money from the Kickstarter is basically going to allow him to publish this engine. So to be able to use for other settings and things. So take a look at that. We'll put a link in the description. So that's the Hope RPG on Kickstarter. So how can people find you?
On Twitter, as always. And mm-hmm. that's at HiveMind, HYVEMYND. I guess I'm also technically on Instagram. I'm also a little bit on Facebook too, but... Mm-hmm. Twitter's the place to find me. Fantastic Fate Patreon is at FAE_fantasy on Twitter, or Fantastic Fate Resources on either Patreon, or that's the blog address as well. Mm-hmm. The theme for this month is Spider Elves, kind of a take on the drow.
Oh, nice.
The end of the month, the Aboleth that I made is going to become public, and I'm also going to try and release some Monster Hunter theme stuff with the serial numbers filed
off.
Nice.
Because
that's cool. One of the few video games I miss playing.
Nice. All right. Monster Hunter World is on sale this month. So.
And if it also came with a time to play it, I would snap that up in a hot second. But as it does not, it'll stay on the shelf.
Yeah. Then moving away from portable does create problems. Yeah. Because, yeah, if you can't play it on the train, then when do you play
it? That's exactly when I played. Like years ago, the number of times I I'm two stops past where I should have done because I was beating this Rathalos. Oops, I guess I'll get off and go the other way. All right. Yeah, not with a kid, not possible.
Right. And you can find me and my cartoons at abusecartoons.com. And I do a live stream every week. So that'll be Sunday night, North American time, and Monday morning, Japan time, where I draw the week's cartoons, take a look at some of the comments from last week, and show off some things that I found at the Japanese convenience store on the way to my computer. And so you can follow that cartoon at Abuse Cartoons on Twitter, and abusecartoons.com is the website, twitch.tv/abusecartoons. Okay, and if you would like to find the podcast or our videos, please visit idleredhands.com. You can follow us on Twitter at idleredhands, the YouTube channel, and also Twitch. So if you're a Twitch subscriber, you get notified because we stream all of our recording sessions, so you get to hear all the foul language and see all the bathroom breaks that we take.
Because that's what people want to see. Yeah.
And if you want to get involved in the podcast and give us suggestions and kind of have input the direction of things and also to kind of help us upgrade cameras and microphones and all that good stuff, please visit patreon.com/idleredhands.
What's the level to back for fewer bathroom breaks?
So that's all for this week. We will be back again next week. Goodbye.
Bye. Out of